Okay, we are back at WDXC 90.7 on the FM dial. And with me this morning, I have some people from Common Ground that I wanted to discuss a few things about. And we have with us Don Wallant, who is the executive director of Common Grounds, and also John Santacross, who is also here. Would you guys like to say hello?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Great, great. And now I just wanted to start out, if you could describe the services that Common Ground offers Greene and Columbia County communities. We can start out by that.
Hi, sure. Common Ground is a grassroots mediation center, and we offer a variety of services that involve alternative dispute resolution, and that involves mediations between individuals who are having any kind of a conflict. In addition to mediation, we also provide conflict resolution workshops to individuals and to youth.
All right. These workshops, what would the workshops be about?
Depends on the community that we're working with. If it's schools, we offer youth workshops to help students mediate, teach them skills to resolve either interpersonal conflicts or to resolve conflicts within their own community. If it's adults, we offer adult workshops along the same lines, teaching mediation and conflict resolution.
Okay. And John, we had talked before too with Common Ground, and you had specifically talked about a specific program that you deal with in Common Ground.
I deal with a parent education program. We call it Forever Parents, and that is geared for parents who are separating or divorcing, and it's designed to help keep the kids out of the fray.
Okay. Can you get into a little bit more about that as far as what you do with the kids and how you help them out?
Well, it's actually the kids aren't the they're the subject of the discussion, but they're not in the room. So we would have the parents come into a workshop. They don't come together. They come at different times. And what we do is we give them tools to use when they're discussing their conflict and how they should keep the children away from that. So if the kids come home, let's say, from a weekend at dad's house and mom's on the next night saying, okay, it's time to go to bed, and the kids were to say, well, dad lets us stay up to whenever we want.
Right.
A lot of times in a high conflict situation, the mother might be saying, well, that's not right. But we're suggesting that they might ask the kids, well, what do you think of that? And do you think that's a good thing for you? Don't you like to get your 8 hours of sleep or whatever it might be? And so it kind of turns the discussion around, and it keeps the kids not out of the middle of the fight.
Right. And I guess that's part and parcel with it, that what you were discussing, Don, about trying to get the communication and learning skills, even if you're at school, if you're at home, if you're dealing with different parents that are dealing with the children. Could you go into a little bit more detail about what Common Ground's main goal is, and what, you know, some of the situations that might be happening that you yourself might have dealt with, or that you offer to help resolve situations?
Sure. Well, I think you have to kind of ask yourself, what is the theories that motivate a program like Common Ground? And what we try to do is to facilitate an understanding between individuals so that they can understand each other and then reach Common Ground. Because if they can't understand each other, then they're not going to be able to communicate well. So that's the real goal of any mediation and any kind of conference or workshop, which is to help individuals understand the other person. And we do that by a variety of ways, by facilitating the conversation, different techniques that a mediator might use, reflecting back what the mediator thinks he or she may have heard, and helping that person hear something that is said in a neutral and a non defensive or offensive way. So that's what happens in a mediation. It's a process. And in workshops, we teach how to become more self-reflective, how to identify one's biases, how to listen without being interrupted, and to try to figure out what your role is in this kind of conflict and what the other person might be looking for from you. So it's a very reflective and a very thoughtful process.
Right.
I mean, don't know if that answers your question.
No, it did. Uh-huh. It did. And in so many ways, I mean, I know that emotions can get in the way of discussion. When either if you're dealing with students, if the students are dealing with situations, they're going through growing difficulties, or they're trying to fit in, or whatever it might be the situation that causes the conflict. And I know, speaking for myself, a lot of times that when your emotions get into it, a wall is built up and you cannot hear what the other person is saying. You're basically thinking of what you want to say to them right off the bat without taking in consideration of what you could do together to resolve the situation.
Well, that's a very good point. Emotions play a huge role in resolving a conflict. And one of the things that I do as a mediator is I encourage people to really not curtail their emotion, because if they do that, it's not really going to be very productive. Sometimes, though, what we try to do is we try to sort of get a pulse in the room as to how someone's emotions might be affecting the other person. So a way to manage that is you establish ground rules from the beginning of the session. And some individuals are very, very, very comfortable with swearing or with name-calling, things that the other person may also be comfortable with. So it depends on the person's dynamic. If you are in a room where someone isn't comfortable with that kind of behavior, only expects civil kinds of responses, you have to lay that out at the beginning. But emotion is something that we are very drawn to. We are not afraid of emotion. We're not afraid of conflict. We're not afraid of managing that dynamic in the room.
Right. John, when we had discussed this before, when you have the mediation part, and as far as you yourself being the mediator, what are some of the things that you do to differentiate? I mean, I know that a lot of times you can get, well, speaking for myself, you can get sucked into the situation where it becomes emotional for you, or it's like you want to give them the answer or basically tell them. Do you understand what I'm saying? You're trying to get from that point where you're trying to get them to figure out the situation for themselves.
Well, I am not normally one of the mediators. We use volunteers who are trained by the center.
Okay.
The key for the mediator is what we're doing, which is counterintuitive for the person that's in the mediation, and that is we're creating a judgment-free zone.
Okay.
And so the mediator's concern is more presenting a process where the parties that are subject to the mediation can openly discuss and not be caught up in being prejudged by, like, I mean, we take referrals from court, for instance. You go in a courtroom, it's adversarial in nature, and there is a judge.
Right.
There is no judge in mediation. And so the discipline of the mediator is to maintain the flow of the communication. And so they very well could be hearing the emotional side of things, but they're, in that sense, they're going to maintain their disinterestedness in the emotional side. You know, as Dawn said, they'll bring out the emotions, but they don't get caught up in those. They use those as a technique or a tool to get issues on the table. And to essentially, if you hear everything from in the discussion, then that might open doors to provide the parties with solutions to their own conflict.
Right.
So that's the challenge of the mediator. The mediator's job is to maintain that neutrality and keep the judgment-free zone open. A lot of people come to us and they want us to affirm their position or their belief, and that's not what they're going to get from us.
Right, right. I wish you were around for some of the political leaders in the world. That would be very helpful. I think our world would be much more united. We'd also discussed that you at one time were involved with in Albany, if I'm correct. You were with the family court?
I am an attorney. Yep. And so for 8 years I was on what was then called the Law Guardian Panel. So that's now called the Attorney for the Child in Albany County's family court. So the family court in Albany County had 3 full-time judges at the time. Now they have 4. Both in Columbia Green counties, we have 2 judges in each county, and one of the hats they wear is family court. They also wear county court and a surrogate court hat. But in family court, we saw a lot of matters. I represented kids, and I also represented indigent adults. I didn't take any private files. I had a private practice, did other things. But when it came to family court, I just dealt with the kids and the indigent adults that were presented to me by the court.
Right.
And so it matters, every type of matter. I mean, we see many of the custody visitation matters come to common ground in the form of mediation referrals. I also sat in on abuse and neglect matters. One parent may be incarcerated seeking access, visitation, juvenile delinquent matters, person in need of supervision. So the beauty of working at Common Ground is, Dawn and I were talking about this yesterday with the Forever Parent program, as much as when I was representing an adult on a custody matter, I would have liked to say, here are some things you should spend your time with as far as rethinking how you communicate. And you could spend, the other night I did one of the Forever Parent programs, and it was basically 4 hours of, here are some tools
right
that you can use to communicate. You couldn't do that when you're representing somebody. Basically, time doesn't call for it.
Well, excuse me for interrupting, but that's the crux of this, so that it's very important to me, is the fact that you do have mediation before the situation happens, or something that can resolve it where it doesn't possibly have to get to a criminal point or somewhere in the court where you are basically told what to do, but you are working it out together as two people, or be it a family, more than two people. And I think that's the vital interest that I have with the program that you guys are offering. I think that's so important that you do offer those services. When people have situations, how do they get a hold of you guys, or what can be offered? What can you tell the people that can be offered?
People are referred by a variety of programs. They can also just self-refer. So, one of the things that would be great is for us to be even more on the radar, rather than having a judge or a police officer or a human services organization make a referral. So that the situation with conflict, if you think about it, is that you really don't think about it until you're having one.
Right.
And even though people are having conflicts all the time, there's not something that comes to their mind right away, like, oh, I should call a dispute resolution program to help resolve this dispute. So that's how we often get our referrals, which is from individuals who are working with other individuals who are in need of service or in some form of crisis, rather than a maintenance kind of program.
Right.
Yeah. So
I had a question too about, there's an afternoon show on Wednesday here, and the discussion there, Big Burn and Slay Diddy, that's their names. They were talking about child support, and they specifically were talking about it from a male perspective, mm-hmm. and how they are dealt with in the courts and so forth and so on. Do you deal with that issue? Is that a mainline issue too that you deal with in your situations?
We don't often receive referrals for child support because it depends on whether the parties are in a position to make a request of each other for a certain amount of money to be...
Well, no, but yeah, I understand that part, yeah. But I'm talking about when people are dealing with how they're, that they have certain responsibilities.
Exactly.
Are the people, do you find that there's a conflict that you do help people out with that for understanding toward that, you know, on both sides?
We can help parents make an agreement regarding child support.
Okay.
Generally, these are handled through the support collections, through the magistrate's office.
Yep.
If parties are comfortable openly talking with each other about what the exchange of support is going to be, we can develop an agreement that will help them come to that agreement, which is then brought to the court and created into a support order.
Okay.
But most of our mediations are regarding custody or visitation rather than child support.
Okay, yeah. That was just something that I heard them talk about last week, and I was also interested in that aspect of it. And one last thing, John, when you had talked about that you had been with the family court in Albany, correct, for 8 years?
Right, as a private attorney, getting assignments from the judges.
Right. And then you said what you have discussed a bit about when you came to Common Ground, the significance of the change that you feel in between the court system and actually having some type of mediation. What else would you say as far as mediation that is helping out for the people versus getting, I guess there was a specific thing that you said that there's an absolute when you get it from the court,
well,
versus having a situation where you can basically say that it was figured out by yourself or the other person that you're dealing with.
What I found, and Dawn could reaffirm this, I'm sure, is that people coming to mediation and come up with their own agreement, they own it. So they go to court, if they've been referred from court, with their agreement, and usually what happens is the court has a copy of the agreement, and maybe the attorney for the child will say, you know, we have, the parents have an agreement, and I support it, because the attorney for the child's not in the mediation room.
Right.
Sometimes they could be, but that's usually a very high conflict, multi-party dynamic. But my experience from the practice side of things was that on some high conflict cases, the parties would want the judge to make a determination. That means that they wanted to have a trial. The last thing the court wants to do is have a trial, especially for custody and visitation, because it's a mm-hmm. no-win situation.
Yep.
And like, for instance, parents living in different school districts. You know, no judge is going to want to have a trial to determine which school is better. And yet, so they try to use as many options available to them, mediation being a primary one, to help the parents get off of their position a little bit, as opposed to going down the trial road. Let's assume, and I've sat through these, you have the trial, and the judge will render a decision. And in that decision, they'll weigh in on the credibility of the witnesses, which are usually primarily the two parents, and then they make determinations, and then they say, this is, and they might issue an order with it, or they'll direct one of the attorneys to prepare the order.
Okay.
And it has the terms that the judge has decided.
Right.
And so usually what happens is, conflict will result later on because
right.
that's not our order.
Right.
That's the judge's order.
Right.
And so me coming to Common Ground gave me an opportunity to be part of the prevention side of the equation, or at least the how do we lower the level of conflict. Because at court, the conflict reaches a point where they come to court. Sometimes the court gives them an opportunity to take a deep breath, leave the courtroom, get a date for mediation, and with some time you might be able to work things out. Because what happens in court, it's kind of any, I'll call it a contrived environment.
Okay.
Because you have this formality that people are not used to.
Right.
You have this person sitting with a black robe on. I mean, where do you go for that other than maybe church?
Right.
You know, and they're sitting higher, physically higher than everybody else in the room.
Right.
And then you have attorneys, and they all wear what I'll call the uniform, the suit,
right,
and tie, and the women wear, you know, like a business dress type of suit. And people are trying to figure out how do I behave, and so it's hard to see who the people are, and it's hard for each of the litigants looking at the other to believe they're listening or hearing that person, because most times they're trying to jump out of their seat and say that's not what they said, that's not what they did.
Right.
So the opportunity to be part of the prevention or the relief side of the equation was and is exciting to me.
Right. No, I think, and I'm going to close out with this part of it, but I mean, I think it's so important to have that mediation resolution to conflict that you guys offer. And I'm very happy that you are getting this out there over the airwaves like you are now.
If I could just interrupt you and say one more thing. One of the things that John touched upon, which is something that's really critical, which is in a mediation setting, the venue is very informal, and it works best with families, with couples. And in addition to providing this, the family, the couple come away feeling like they have accomplished something, and they are, at least through assimilation, practicing skills and tools to have that dialogue. So they can come back at any time and not have another successful interaction, which is what happens. Oftentimes people come back to common ground after they have successfully mediated something because they've experienced for the first time in a very long time success.
Right.
And that's a very powerful feeling. Mediation is a very empowering process for individuals. And as John said, in a court setting, it's very disempowering. And people are expected to be told what to do, whereas mediation says, no, you have these answers.
Yes.
You
yep.
can do this.
Yep.
And that's why it works.
Right on. How can people get a hold of you if they would like to, or if they want to refer somebody else, or if whatever the need for getting a hold of you, how could they do that?
There are a couple of ways. One is we have a phone number, which, can I say the phone?
Yes, you can.
Okay. It's 518-943-0523. We are also on the web, www.commongroundinc.org. So
okay.
Either way.
That's perfect. And now I wanted to get into a very important another situation that I wanted to talk about. That there's a conference that is being offered for the people, and it's happening in September. Let me see here. What do we got here?
13th.
Okay, September 13th at Columbia Greene County
Community College.
Yeah. In the time. But before we started that, I just wanted to give some really disheartening statistics about elder abuse. The average number of elderly abuse cases each year is 2,150,000. The percentage of elderly population that will experience some type of abuse is 9.5%. The top reported cases is neglect, which is 58.5% of the cases that come in. And if you go into the nursing homes alone, the elderly population in the United States is growing at a dramatic rate. And 2010 census determined that more than 40 million people in the United States, or more than 13% of the population, are more than 65 years old, and almost 6 million individuals in a group are more than 85 years old. And between 1999 and 2001, almost one-third of all nursing home facilities were cited for violations. One-third of all nursing homes of federal standards that could cause harm or did harm elderly residents in those facilities. And nearly 10% of those homes had violations that posted a risk of serious injury or death. More than 40% of nursing home residents have reported abuse, and more than 90% report that they or another resident of the facility have been neglected. I think those are so disheartening statistics, and it. But you are putting on a seminar. If you could talk about that again, if you could give the dates and the time and
sure.
what's being offered at that seminar.
Thank you. Yep, the seminar is almost a full day. It's between 10 and 3 on September 13th. And the goal of the conference, I should tell you first, is to do exactly what you just did, which is to raise awareness of the condition of elder abuse in our communities and to develop a response to that, to develop whether it's a safety net or to try to influence legislation that will protect our vulnerable seniors. The conference will consist of a series of panelists. We're going to open with Assemblywoman Dede Barrett, and the speakers include District Attorney Paul Chaika from Columbia County, Lou Pirro, who is a very well-known elder attorney. There will be Colleen Bartel, who is the Adult Protective Director at DSS in Columbia County. There will be a representative from New York State Office for the Aging. And there'll be a forensic / detective social worker who will also be there to help people identify abuse.
Okay.
So it's a panel discussion. And then after the discussion, we hope to break out into working groups to develop at least the beginning of what can we do about this. So we're hopefully going to be able to do this annually and develop a very strong community response team to this situation.
Okay, well, it seems like you have a lot of varied people that are involved with that, and that's great. And there are a lot of services being offered for that, and I read the statistics off for you. It's pretty disheartening, and I think that the population, as I also read, is aging at such a rate that it's going to be more than it's ever been in history. And I think it's very important that people do consider, you know, going to the conference as far as learning the information for that.
Can I just interrupt you? To the emotional and physical abuse, there's also financial exploitation, which is also going to be talked about at the conference, which is another very serious issue that are affecting our seniors.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, there's so many scams going on that over the internet, and John, we had talked about that too before, even referring to children. The internet, the power of the internet, how it can be powerful for usefulness and helping out, but in certain respects, it can be devastating to especially the elderly that are so vulnerable in so many different ways. So we're going to leave it at that. I would like to maybe even talk about, I wish we could, I guess we had talked to John about Penny that deals with youth education. Is that what we were talking about?
Yeah.
With that, and maybe next time we can get all of you guys in again to talk about that, to maybe delve a little bit more into that. I want to let you know that I really appreciate you guys getting on here. This is such a fundamental situation that needs to be brought out in the open more, where we can hopefully resolve it and resolve it in mediation, or even if it's for the elderly, we can help them out in certain respects too. So once again, if you could give the dates for the conference again.
The date is September 13th between 10 and 3.
Okay. Well, Don and John, I really appreciate you being here. And like I said, I'd like to have you back here again, and otherwise have a great day.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, that I very much enjoyed it. And part and parcel that the song that I'm going to play is it's called Youth at Heart Chorus, and Youth at Heart Chorus started in 1982 for members that lived in an elderly housing project in Northampton, Massachusetts, called the Walter Salvo House, and the residents from there have been from both world wars. A lady actually sang in that chorus up until she was 100 years old, I think that just shows that it doesn't matter how old you are, you can still make beautiful music. And they are doing actually a rendition of a John Lennon song called Nobody Told Me. So stay tuned, and we'll be back with the news.
3, 4. Something happening.